contribution they've made to construction in this country. All that after a quick media review, though. Here's what other news outlets are saying. Tasnim News notes, as has the Financial Tribune, that the U.S. wouldn't help without gain. It just makes a mess and leaves it behind. U.S. West never help others. Have inflicted carnage on Afghans, says the Iranian president. President of Iran Ebrahim Raisi decried the policies of the U.S. and other Western governments that have never proved useful in settling the problems of other nations, saying they have only wreaked havoc on the Afghan people over the past 20 years. The U.S. and Westerners have never untangled any problem facing other nations and will not do so in future either, the president stated. He pointed to the American invasion of Afghanistan, saying the Western policies have only wreaked havoc on Afghan people for 20 years and have not brought about anything but carnage. Tasnim echoes exchanges between the UN and Iran. UN chief hails Iran for hosting Afghan refugees. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, described Iran as a very influential country among the UN member states and praised the Islamic Republic for hosting Afghan refugees generously. In a telephone conversation with Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian on Thursday evening, September the 9th, Guterres congratulated the top Iranian diplomat on taking office. He then appreciated the efforts of Iran in generously hosting Afghan refugees, stressing his commitment to supporting Iran's efforts in hosting the displaced persons. For his part, Amir Abdullahian emphasized Iran's readiness to cooperate with the UN to find a political solution to the current situation in Afghanistan, in line with talks held during the meeting of the foreign ministers of Afghanistan's neighbors. Tehran Times tells of talented Afghans getting scholarships. Iranian University to grant more scholarships to Afghans. At the seventh meeting of the Board of Trustees of Allama Tabatabai University, it was approved that the university awards scholarships to 35 faculty members and talented students of Afghanistan annually with the aim of expanding scientific and cultural ties between the academic community and the media of the two countries. Accordingly, Allama is the first Iranian university to offer scholarships to faculty members, talented students, and Afghan journalists since 2016, with the aim of expanding scientific and cultural ties between the two countries. The number of recipients of this scholarship in previous years was 20, which has increased to 35 this year. Some 57,675 foreign nationals from 133 countries are studying in Iranian universities, many of whom have returned to their country with the outbreak of the pandemic, Afshin Akhundzadeh, an official at the Organization of Student Affairs, has said. That would be it for the news segment, but do stay tuned. A number of scientific board members of Tehran University's medical faculty have set out to provide medical services to Afghan nationals in Yas Clinic. Some 25% of corona cases in the region are Iran's to deal with, but that is overshadowed by the situation in Afghanistan. At least it is to these doctors. The root medical problem would be insurance, but Iranian governments have been seeing to that to their best capability. Mr. Abedi is an Afghan affairs expert who joined us on Skype. Let's hear him out.
Currently, illegal immigrants to Europe are usually kept in refugee camps for years, but we see that many Afghan refugees are presently living in Iran's cities. They are able to utilize a plethora of services provided for them. Right now, aid services for impoverished areas and those living on the margins are being offered by the IRGC and Basij. These all-inclusive services are being implemented regardless of nationality and race and are also being provided for Afghans in Iran. Aid packages are being distributed amongst Afghans as well.
Yas Clinic is the first medical stronghold specially set up for Afghans, and several doctors' offices in Tehran have volunteered their free services to that clinic. That would be on Tuesdays and Wednesdays for all Afghans, be they passport or Amayesh card holders, or undocumented. The clinic started work late August in Tehran's Yas hospital complex and has offered services in several fields, namely brain and kidney surgery.
Iran has many good features for us, and without them, we wouldn't choose Iran as a place to live. Living here has advantages and disadvantages for us, but in general, I have been satisfied with conditions so far. I have many Iranian friends that I really care about, and I love the people of Iran. Many Iranians supported my cafe. Many also helped me with obtaining operational licenses.
Now, it's not just immigrants with high prospects Iran welcomes. There were some 3,700 exceptional Afghan students studying in this country as of August last year. Like Iranian students, they are provided with educational, rehabilitation, and physical training services. But what are future prospects? There are those in a hurry to get away and into Iran, but they got stuck along the way. Our principal's own sister is stuck in Mazar Sharif. That's closer to the Uzbek border than the nearly 950-kilometer border shared between Afghanistan and Iran. Still, she wants to come here.
My sister is over there with her five children. Before the fall of Mazar Sharif, she had begun the process of obtaining a visa to come to Iran. But unfortunately, the Iranian embassy there was closed. So now they are still there. But before the embassy closed and the arrival of the Taliban, Iran was expediting the visa issuance process. In this time, a visa that could normally take at least 2 months for approval was being issued in 3 to 4 days, so that people who needed to leave could do so. So the Iranian embassy was very cooperative and helpful with the situation.
Afghans appear to favor Iran for language, culture, tribal, and historic commonalities with this country, commonalities the Americans appear to have tried to dampen during their 20-year occupation of Afghanistan. Doesn't sound like any such efforts actually worked, though.
Because we share the same language, if you go to Kabul and speak with an Iranian accent, most people will understand what you're saying. But they may not understand the Farsi accent of a person from Tajikistan or Uzbekistan. This is because we both share similar language and cultures. People here wear hijab and they can identify with Iranians and their lifestyles.
Dari, the Afghan dialect of Persian, is one of Afghanistan's two official languages and is used by intellectuals and the elite. Until 1857, Herat was a part of Iran, and only after Iran and Britain signed the Paris Treaty of 1857 did Iran abandon its claim, although it did reserve the right to send forces to Afghanistan if its frontier is violated.
Afghanistan as Dore.
Afghanistan was part of Iran in the Achaemenid period, in the era before Islam known as the Aryan period. In modern history, colonial competition was taking form in the region between Britain and Russia in the 19th century. Britain's goal was to preserve its interests in India in this colonial period. During the Qajar dynasty, Britain encouraged the Afghan ruler in Herat to separate from Iran. At this time, two battles broke out between Iran and British forces. They also took over some of Iran's islands in the southern seas. During this time, Britain forced the Qajar king, who was considered to be dependent on foreign nations, to sign the Paris Accord, which separated Afghanistan from Iran.
This is not to say there's no work to be done in Iran by stretching its means, but only to a point of not breaking. Iran, after all, is suffering an economic plight of its own. Iran has inclusive policies, which is why refugees and even undocumented foreign nationals affected by COVID-19 can approach hospitals and health posts and access free of charge COVID-19 testing, treatment, and hospitalization, in the same way Iranian nationals can. It's basically a matter of luck where you get hospital bed and service, public or private. In 2020, a third of the 300,000 most vulnerable refugees got to get enrolled in health insurance, given COVID-19 had stretched the health services really thin. International support is needed more than ever in this country to avoid exacerbating refugees' vulnerabilities. In emergency situations like what Afghans are facing, even short-term aid counts. Beginning April 2020, UNHCR and the Iranian government rolled out a gift cards project that consisted of one-off cash grants to cover 3 months' worth of minimum expenditure baskets. As of June 2020, almost 5,000 persons had been assisted with this gift cards project.
Living conditions have been good in many ways. Right now, we are able to obtain driver's licenses. Of course, those who have passports are able to get driver's licenses. They can open bank accounts and purchase cell phone numbers in their own names, and many other facilities have been given to us, which are, in my opinion, among the advantages meeting our needs.
As for political solutions to Afghans' agony, early in September, the Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian had a chat with former Afghan President Hamid Karzai to confirm Iran's support of dialogue among all groups in Afghanistan. This would be to form an inclusive government which reflects the ethnic and demographic makeup of the country. This is the only way for Afghanistan to reach lasting peace, Abdollahian said. Karzai confirmed he and other elders were engaged in negotiations with different groups, including the Taliban. Abdollahian also said Iran would keep its border crossings with Afghanistan open to ease the current situation in that country, and it would continue to trade with Afghanistan. Keeping the border open all along, however, was not feasible. Families are getting through, but border guards are wary of single men, as they could be drug dealers or terrorists, going by accounts. That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after, though, as you never know what's on. Till next week, bye.
Rabbi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Rabbi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Rabbi English Radio.
The limelight.
Up to half of the $14 trillion spent by the Pentagon since 9/11 went to for-profit defense contractors, a study released recently found. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Ellen Nickmeyer, writer. This article is published under the heading, Study Shows Pentagon Reliance on Contractors Hurt U.S. in 9/11 Wars. Stay tuned for more. Up to half of the $14 trillion spent by the Pentagon since 9/11 went to for-profit defense contractors, a study released recently found. While much of this money went to weapons suppliers, the research is the latest to point to the dependence on contractors for war zone duties as contributing to mission failures, in Afghanistan in particular. In the post-9/11 wars, U.S. corporations contracted by the Defense Department not only handled war zone logistics like running fuel convoys and staffing CHO lines, but performed mission-crucial work like training and equipping Afghan security forces that collapsed last month as the Taliban swept the country. Within weeks and before the U.S. military had even completed its withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Taliban easily rooted an Afghan government and military that Americans had spent 20 years and billions of dollars to stand up. President Biden placed blame squarely on the Afghan themselves. He said, "We gave them every chance. What we could not provide them was the will to fight. But William Hartung, the author of the recent study by Brown University's Cost of War Project and the Center for International Policy and others, say it's essential that Americans examine what role their reliance on private contractors played in the post-9/11 wars. In Afghanistan, that included contractors allegedly paying protection money to warlords and the Taliban themselves, and the Defense Department insisting on equipping the Afghan Air Force with complex Black Hawk helicopters and other aircraft that few but U.S. contractors knew how to maintain. If it were only the money, that would be outrageous enough. Hartung, the director of the Arms and Security Program at the Center for International Policy, said of instances where the Pentagon's reliance on contractors backfired, adding, "But the fact it undermined the mission and put troops at risk is even more outrageous." At the start of this year, before Biden began the final American withdrawal from Afghanistan, there were far more contractors in Afghanistan and also in Iraq than U.S. troops. The U.S. saw about 7,000 military members die in all post-9/11 conflicts and nearly 8,000 contractors, another cost of war study estimates. Professional Services Council, an organization representing businesses contracting with the government, cited a lower figure from the U.S. Department of Labor, saying nearly 4,000 federal contractors have been killed since 2001. Spokeswoman pointed to a statement last month from the organization's president, David J. Berto. "For almost two decades, government contractors have provided broad and essential support for the U.S. and allied forces, for the Afghan military and other elements of the Afghan government, and for humanitarian and economic development assistance," unquote. U.S. officials, after the September 11, 2001 attacks, embraced private contractors as an essential part of the U.S. military response. It started with then-Vice President Dick Cheney, the former CEO of Halliburton. Halliburton received more than $30 billion to help set up and run bases, feed troops, and carry out other work in Iraq and Afghanistan by 2008, the study says. Cheney and defense contractors argued that relying on private contractors for work that service members did in previous wars would allow for a trimmer U.S. military and be more efficient and cost-effective. By 2010, Pentagon spending had surged by more than one-third as the U.S. fought dual wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. In a post-9/11 American politician's bid to show support for the military in a country grown far more security conscious. "Any member of Congress who doesn't vote for the funds we need to defend this country will be looking for a new job after next November," the study notes. Harry Stone Cipher, then vice president of Boeing, telling the Wall Street Journal the month after the attacks. And up to a third of the Pentagon contracts went to just five weapons supplier. Last fiscal year, for example, the money Lockheed Martin alone got from Pentagon contracts was 1.5 times the entire budgets of the State Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development, according to the study. The Pentagon pumped out more contracts than it could oversee, lawmakers and government special investigators said. For example, a Florida Republican Party official made millions on what lawmakers charged were excess profits when the U.S. granted a one-of-a-kind contract for fuel convoys from Jordan to Iraq, the study notes. The electrocution of at least 18 service members by bad writings in bases in Iraq, some of it blamed on major contractor Kellogg, Brown, and Root, was another of many instances where government investigations pointed to shoddy logistics and reconstruction work. The stunning Taliban victory last month in Afghanistan is drawing attention now to even graver consequences. The extent to which the U.S. reliance on contractors may have heightened the difficulties of Afghan security forces. Judy Vittori, a former Air Force Lieutenant Colonel and scholar of corruption and fragile states at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who was not involved in the study, points to the U.S. insistence that the Afghan Air Force use U.S.-made helicopters. Afghans preferred Russian helicopters, which were easier to fly, could be maintained by Afghans, and were suited to rugged Afghanistan. Hartung, like others, also points to the corruption engendered by the billions of loosely monitored dollars that the U.S. poured into Afghanistan as one central reason that Afghanistan's U.S.-backed government lost popular support, and Afghan fighters lost morale. Hillary Clinton, while Secretary of State under President Barack Obama, accused defense contractors at risk in war zones of resorting to payoffs to armed groups, making protection money one of the biggest sources of funding for the Taliban.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, 20 years have passed since the attack on the World Trade Center in New York on September 11, 2001. 2,977 people were killed in the various terrorist attacks that day. Now, then U.S. President George W. Bush declared Washington's war on terror. Since then, that war has caused at least 1 million people to be killed around the world. And millions of others have become refugees while terrorism has expanded. And this 9/11, like 9/11 in 2001, the Taliban is in power in Afghanistan. So what was accomplished besides death and destruction in the U.S.'s war on terror? Now I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight. Author and journalist Jim Kavanaugh out of New York. And author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman out of Washington, D.C. Thank you both for being with us.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start this off, staying in D.C. and with Michael. Michael, there's still so much mystery and confusion behind the whole attacks on 9/11. Why do you think that's still the case 20 years later?
Well, I think it's because you keep a whole series of stories rolling out. You'll never get down to the basics of the real story, as one African journalist told me. You have explanations and possibilities, and you throw these out, you confuse people with what they're hearing. Anyone who questions the knowledge that jet fuel burning doesn't melt steel is denounced as a conspiracy theorist and as some kind of agent of some disinformation campaign. You don't get the clear story on anything. And the emphasis is always on something else, on the Saudis, on the Taliban, or Osama bin Laden, but you hear nothing at all about the involvement of the Israeli government and the dancing Israelis in New Jersey during the collapse of the towers. There's all sorts of stories, but you are not permitted to get to the real story.
Okay. Well, Jim, why do you think, let's go with, of course, Michael just talked about the Saudi involvement or the lack thereof, but let's look at that. Why do you think that the country where most of the hijackers were from, Saudi Arabia, was actually never attacked?
Because American oil businesses need Saudi Arabia, and the American, and also the American strategic plan for the world depends on having those conservative monarchist regimes, anti-nationalist regimes in place. They've been since Franklin Delano Roosevelt made the deal with King Fahd, I think it was, that they would be an American ally in the Middle East and be a bulwark against any kind of secular socialist, certainly nationalism. And that's the role that they play. And they're also enormously powerful and wealthy. And the Bush family itself at 9/11 was, linked up through the Carlyle Group of Saudi Arabia. So, Saudi Arabia plays a crucial role for the United States, both financially and politically in the world, and therefore they can be as radically Islamist fundamentalist as they want.
So Jim, what are you saying? What are we saying when we say that? I mean, all of this and the whole pomp and circumstances, and of course, it was a very somber occasion, and George W. Bush and talking about that we're going to get the terrorists and you can't do this to America. So are you telling me that that Saudi relationship is more important than the thousands of lives that were taken in the United States on 9/11?
Well, I'm telling you that the issue of thousands of lives that were taken became secondary very quickly. It was from the moment it happened, it was quite clear, and we know this from firsthand accounts, that the administration was hell-bent on going after Iraq, on using this as a springboard, as an excuse to go after Iraq, essentially, eventually. So they weren't interested that much in the thousands. They were interested in what they could use it for in terms of their own geostrategic plans.
And, okay, and we're going to talk Saudi about Arabia I'm going to talk about target. Iraq a little bit later in the program. But, Michael, Afghanistan was attacked allegedly to get whom the U.S. alleged was the mastermind behind 9/11, Osama bin Laden. But after all the troops and firepower sent into Afghanistan, the U.S. did not get him there. How can the U.S. justify the invasion of Afghanistan when its main mission wasn't even accomplished there, and appears that the job could have actually been done by special forces who allegedly did do the job in Pakistan?
Well, there's no justification whatsoever for the destruction of Afghanistan, the Afghan people, their culture, their society, their infrastructure. It was simply a move to further weaken a Muslim country and following on from other Muslim countries such as Iraq. We've got the idea that the Americans are a city upon the hill, that they can do no wrong, that the world looks up to them because of their great democratic values, when such events as Afghanistan showed that those values have no meaning whatsoever. They're all fantasy. And, of course, the Americans were told that Osama bin Laden was in Afghanistan and asked the Afghans for him, and the Afghans simply said, well, yeah, give us some justification, give us some reason to get him over, and we'll do it. And the Americans never could, and I guess to this day, 20 years later, still never would justify their demands for bin Laden and to act expeditiously when the Taliban offered to hand him over.
Well, Jim, as you were talking about Iraq, let's look at Iraq, which was another country attacked during the U.S.'s war on terrorism, and of course the alleged reason the Iraqi regime's possession of weapons of mass destruction was a total lie. That country was destroyed. Who pays, Jim? What happens? Who pays? I mean, we're talking about this on this 20-year anniversary, which of course is a sad occasion for Americans and other people in the world. But who pays for these other lives that have been destroyed, countries that have been destroyed, like Iraq?
Well, the people of those countries pay, most of all. I mean, look, as an American, we pay. We pay in terms of our public money, in terms of the lives of the soldiers who have been lost. But overwhelming, it's not only the people of the countries, but the infrastructure of the countries, the whole collective structure of the countries that has been destroyed. You know, I was born and raised in New York, and I was living less than a mile away from the World Trade Center on September 11th. But I was also happened to be that day in an Arab and Muslim country on September 11th, 2001. And everybody in the country was sympathetic, expressing their solidarity, their horror at what happened. And what the United States did is use the events as a springboard for attack and demolish Muslim countries around the world, starting with Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and do away with all that goodwill and turn it to resentment and hatred and for good reasons. And so what you have is, you know, when you watch a country like Iraq, when you watch bridges being blown up, I mean, that takes something to build a bridge. You know, that destroys the infrastructure of a country. So the United States went around and did that for 20 years, committing 9/11s against the people of those countries, you know, monthly or whatever. And that's what happened. The people of those countries pay, and they're still paying.
Yeah, well, Michael, we know that former U.S. General Wesley Clark, who revealed that right after the 9/11 attacks, that the Pentagon had made the decision to attack 7 countries in 5 years. What does all of this mean? Was this all pre-planned?
Yes, indeed. The whole thing started with recruiting terrorists for Afghanistan. Recruited in the CIA's Jeddah Consulate, where I served, and was ordered to issue terrorist visas to recruitment offices in the United States in almost every state, including Washington, D.C. The people involved in the Afghan War decided that they had created a cadre of people who were very good at blowing things up and shooting things down. And I went into great detail in this in my book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World, when I talked about the creation of the Arab-Afghan Legion, essentially crazy Muslim fighters, as Cheryl Bernard said, the most extreme people that they could find and the most dangerous, to overthrow the government of Afghanistan. And then later on, of course, the Americans saw that they had a marvelous cadre, and they used that cadre in Yugoslavia, headed up by Osama bin Laden. And that's what created the name-changing Islamic terrorist base. It started out with Al-Qaeda, and then it became ISIS, and then it became IS, and it may morph into something else, but they are essentially the same people the Americans had recruited and trained and financed with the help of course, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And these people were essentially the basis for the destruction and the overthrow of these five countries in 7 years. They were countries the Americans didn't trust, didn't like. They were too socialist, like Yugoslavia. They were too secular, like Iraq or Syria. And there were, of course, many instances in the Arab and Muslim world. They were enemies of Israel. And, of course, Israel dictates American policy. You had these people that were not as organized as the United States Marines, but could be aimed and let loose in any direction in any country that the United States wanted to see founder. And this has been planned from the highest levels down. It's kept up the planning throughout several administrations. You had its basis, in fact, in this project for the New American Century, which was a rewrite of a paper prepared for the apartheid entity's government on military control of the region. So it was basically planned well in advance and executed markedly, remarkably well. And, of course, the propaganda got better and better. And the planning and the organization got better and better through more and skilled practice. So we see it now today everywhere in the world, and it's not the American invasion or the Israeli threat of invasion or the Israeli bombing or whatever. It's something wrong with that country. We have a responsibility to protect the people living there, and we have to help them, and we have to overthrow this repressive government and replace it with a puppet government of our own.
Michael, when you say, sorry to jump in here, but when you say pre-planned, I mean, because also the catalyst for the other side of all of this was the 9/11 attacks itself. Was that also pre-planned, you think, or not?
Well, when I was in Jeddah in the late 1980s and early 90s, I was ordered to issue visas to people that the CIA and the American government wanted to have, such as an Iranian working in a rogue shop in Jeddah. The CIA base chief wanted me to bring him to the United States because we wanted to have a conversation with him and a debriefing session and whatever. And I was in charge of the non-immigrant visa section. This happened several successes of mine. Shana Steinger issued 11 visas to the 15 Saudis who got their visas while in the kingdom. And of course, Shana Steinger went on for 20 more years in the State Department, despite having issued the visas that brought down a couple of tall, ugly buildings in New York City. So I think that, it was planned, it was carefully planned, and it was a long, drawn-out process.
Well, Jim, I mean, what was accomplished with this whole war on terror? The U.S. is poorer, its reputation worse, the world is less safe, and the U.S. has lost the war in Afghanistan. So what was gained from all of this?
Well, I think it's important to realize that something was gained, and the people who wanted to do it got what they wanted. They
Let's talk about what does that mean, the people? Which people, and what did they get?
I think primarily the Israeli lobby in the United States. They wanted the destruction of any powerful state that was a resistant state to Israel. They wanted the destruction of Iraq and of the Iraqi army and of the Iraqi state, the coherence of the Iraqi state. They were very mad in 1991 when Bush 1 didn't go forward and go into Baghdad. And Dick Cheney at the time said, if we do that, it's crazy. There'll be chaos in Iraq. But they kept pressing that issue. The Israeli lobby in the United States is very powerful. And it's not, it's not just an exogenous thing. I mean, hundreds and thousands of people who work in the foreign policy apparatus are convinced that the interests of Israel should be the interests of the United States. So Israel got the destruction of the Iraqi state. They got the destruction of all the axes of resistance. Libya. They got the destruction of Libya. These were states that provided financial support to the Palestinian resistance. They've succeeded in weakening the Syrian state to the point where it has to defend itself constantly against attack, and it's a third of its territory is still occupied. So from the point of view, and the Israeli ministers have said it, we'd much rather have ISIS in power than Assad in Syria. They wanted to destroy systematically look at the states that were targeted, the axes of resistance to Israeli colonialism and Israeli hegemony in the Middle East, And that's why the next one is, they haven't finished with Syria, and their next target is Iran, because they've done away with a lot of the others. So it's been a great success in a lot of ways for people who want, for that program, which was the Anon program. I think Michael was referring to that, and the project for the New American Century program. So, you know, people have to realize they weren't being stupid or they weren't misunderstanding. American people were, because they were being fed a narrative that had nothing to do with what was going on. But, and that's one of the reasons why Afghanistan, they will pull troops out of Afghanistan, because it's very important. It doesn't impact centrally the issue of Israel and the Zionist supremacy in the Middle East. And so it's going to be, Afghanistan in some sense was for the Americans, the American political class, an amuse-bouche of certain kind to get the American people ready for the war in Iraq, the attack on Iraq.
Well, Michael, you talked about the dancing Israelis before, and now Jim has just talked about the Israeli lobby benefiting from all of this. Of course, this is not talked about on mainstream media in the United States and probably would not even be allowed. What does this all mean, though, at the end of the day for the American people? That basically they have been sacrificed for the sake of the Zionist state, and who has to do the job to basically be able to inform the American people in order to bring a change if all of this is true?
Well, this whole thing has happened because the Israelis control the news media, whether it's radio, television stations, newspapers, or you name it. They have access, they have control. You look at there's something like five or six corporations controlling news media in the United States, and if you look at the names, they are Jews or appear to be Jews, and it's their narrative that gets out. And as the African journalist I quoted earlier said, these are the people that have the money, and people with an alternative viewpoint who have a real insight into the situation cannot make any money at it, because there are no organizations that are going to pay them for their reportage. So it's basically information control, and the Americans unfortunately accept all of this. They believe that their government is right, that they're being told the truth, that you can't possibly question Washington and its foreign policy decisions. So what it's going to take is a major revolution from the bottom up in the United States, and organizations that are willing to be formed that will pay people, good journalists, to write the truth and not what Tel Aviv or Washington, D.C. dictates. So the whole issue is basically information control and getting around it, and that's extremely difficult.
All right, I would love to continue this conversation, but unfortunately we are out of time. I thank both of you for being with me, author and journalist Jim Kavanaugh out of New York, and author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman out of Washington, D.C. And thank you so much for staying with us on Another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
There is now a growing feeling that the U.S. unipolar moment is not only ending, but has been squandered, says Marco Cornelis Ryder in an article titled, America's Exceptionalism Will Ultimately Be Its Downfall. Stay tuned for more. If what has happened to America during the past 20 years, the so-called war on terror, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the 2008 financial crisis, Donald Trump's election, the COVID-19 pandemic, the assault on the U.S. Capitol, and ultimately, the humiliating exit from Kabul feels like deja vu, that's because it is. The fall of Kabul to the Taliban takes the mind back to Saigon and the 1970s, another difficult decade for America. Back then, as now, the U.S. had been polarized by widespread protest and had been humiliated after the Vietnam War, with America's European and Asian allies puzzled by its behavior. The Watergate scandal put an abrupt end to Richard Nixon's so-called imperial presidency. Two oil shocks at the beginning and end of the decade, including the humiliating U.S. hostage crisis, set in motion a global recession and widespread concerns and anxieties about American power. Yet, in the decade following the turbulent 1970s, America reinvented itself, presiding over the single most transformational event of 20th century's second half, the end of the Cold War and the subsequent collapse of the Soviet Union, only hastened by USSR's fatal mistake of invading Afghanistan in 1979. America's unipolar era had arrived. A few years later, 9/11 offered America another challenge. What followed is well known, an era of U.S. hyperpower that may have just symbolically ended in Kabul. There is now a growing feeling that the U.S. unipolar moment is not only ending, but has been squandered. Long before Kabul's fall, many in the international community had been asking if a major new era of world history was upon Americans, a new world order is in the making. And if so, according to which rules and decided by whom? Recently, The Economist invited some global thinkers to address the topic of American power. Francis Fukuyama emphasized that America overestimated the effectiveness of military power to bring about fundamental political change, even as it underestimated the impact of its free market economic model on global finance. While he correctly pointed to mistaken calculations, he ignored the core roots which may have driven them. Niall Ferguson framed America's demise with the British imperial experience, but he succeeded only in asserting banalities such as that the retreat from global dominance is rarely a peaceful process, and in blaming Barack Obama's renunciation of global policing. Henry Kissinger explained what went wrong in Afghanistan by emphasizing only America's inability to define attainable goals and to link them in a way that is sustainable by the American political process. Robert Kaplan asserted that in the era of climate change and of the fourth industrial revolution, Their conflicts revolve around big data, artificial intelligence, 5G, cyber war, and quantum computing. Geography still matters, and it still helps the U.S. Hardly any of them address the big elephant in the room where U.S. power is concerned, American exceptionalism. Over the last four decades, China has been very smart in its use of soft power, such as through its massive Belt and Road Initiative. Washington has not only lost its skills in blending hard and soft power, but it has also been too keen on using the hard one. When it did opt for soft power, it used sanctions by the rest, by the weaponization of the dollar and the U.S. Treasury financial blacklisting of foes and friends alike. Pretending to sustain a rules-based world order only on a binary choice, either you are with us or you're against us, it is not the best recruiting tool. Quite useful also would be the dropping of the conviction that any country questioning the liberal and globalized world order is evil and immoral, an example of fanaticism typical of a retrograde civilization, and above all, that such questioning always constitutes a threat to the security of the United States. Most importantly, restoring American credibility requires the abandonment of the frequently practiced hubristic belief that the rules of such a world order apply to all nations but the U.S. Arnold Toynbee said that the encounter between the West and the world has been modern history's capital event. Now, after five centuries of Western dominance marked by the Renaissance, the great geographical discoveries, the Enlightenment, the political, industrial, and scientific revolutions, and since 1917, progressively led by the United States, the world as we have always known it might become more complex and multipolar. The rise of Eurasia, climate change, pandemics, and the fourth industrial revolution mean that the West might not occupy center stage in the future. The 21st century is seeing a tectonic historical shift. Instead of framing it as an epic of clash between democracy and authoritarianism, for the sole purpose of maintaining its more and more unsustainable hegemony, America would do better to manage this process constructively and pragmatically. To make a start, it must drop its flaunted exceptionalism.